Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, we have old friend Ben Gordon back to talk about music, how it's changed, and how the social engineering had got its hooks into the music industry and radically changed it to, I mean, that's my perspective of advancing this whole social engineering, cultural Marxist agenda. And I'd like to get Ben's thoughts on that. And before Ben takes the floor here, I just wanted to add a couple of things just for my perspective as being kind of a professional music listener. Growing up, I had these cousins come over from the Philippines, and they brought this hoard of records with them, right? This would have been late 1960s, early 1970s. So at an early age, I was listening to Cream, The Who, Led Zeppelin, all these great classic rock and roll bands. And then one of my cousins was a gal, and she brought a whole bunch of Motown records. So, on the one hand, I'm listening to hard rock, classic rock, Deep Purple in Rock. That was a great album. And on the other hand, I'm listening to Smokey Robinson, Aretha Franklin, The Temptations, The Supremes. So I had kind of that grounding of music. And if you go back to the days when, okay, like for example, when Rock Around the Clock first premiered in theaters in Europe, guys went crazy, started thrashing a place. Something about the music instilled this primal tribal rage within them, right? And they, for lack of a better thing to do, they just kind of thrashed the theaters and what have you, where they saw this movie, Bill Haley and the Comets. And then you fast forward a little faster, a little more in the future, the British invasion, the Beatles. And with their, by our standards today, these puny sound systems, it's questionable whether anyone in these vast stadiums, Candlestick Park, Shea Stadium, actually even heard the music amidst the din of all these women screaming, right? So something was going on where probably not even at a conscious level, all of these women, females, and all the way down to these preteens and teenagers were just screaming, "My Kundalini is activated, my Kundalini is activated," but they weren't thinking that. That was something that was happening at a very deep physiological level. Eyewitnesses at Shea Stadium reported seeing streams, rivulets of urine going down the stairs in the stadium from all the females that were pissing themselves, right? So I just point this out, and Jimmy Page also said that, the thing about music is you have to be careful with frequency. You can do all kinds of things, manipulate people's feelings, influence them in a negative way or a positive way. So we're going to talk about that because we've clearly seen over the years a transition from empowering, feel-good type of music to what we have today, which passes for a music scene. So without any further ado, bring in my musician friend, Ben Gordon. Ben, how are you?
I'm doing really, really good. I worked on music all day, as a matter of fact. I have a very music brain right now. Mixing and recording and doing stuff like that.
Tell us from your perspective, because we're pretty much of the same age,
Yeah.
and probably similar musical influences. Tell me from your perspective, as far as how you got into music and then how you've seen it change over the years. And I'll have some more thoughts on that, as we go on.
My earliest memories were I have this weird photographic memory when it comes to music. I do not have a photographic memory in general. However, I know where I was the first time I heard every song I've ever heard. Like, I have a connection to it. My mom told me years ago that when I was a baby, I was singing in my crib and being melodious. Like actually stringing melodies together. So I was kind of born with the ability to do that. So I would hear songs at a store shopping with my mom, and I would stop and I would be like, "What is this?" And then she would ask one of the adults, and I'd be like, "I want to get that 45." And a lot of times, for me, for young me, if I heard, and I actually have a guitar in my hand right now, if I heard any distorted guitar, I was in. If I heard some sort of hard rock, ooh, guitar, I needed that song. And so I had a pretty good musical brain before I ever even picked up a guitar. I already had perfect pitch and things like that. Well, I locked on to like heavy metal because that was cool. Kiss. It was Kiss. I have report cards that say Ben is very bright. However, he'll do much better in his classes if he stops drawing pictures of Kiss all day, because I was obsessed. But it wasn't until I started listening to the more classic rock, Led Zeppelin and things like that, The Who, Led Zeppelin, and Motown. It's funny that you bring up Motown, because Motown continues to kick my ass, like unbelievable musicianship. And the vibe around these musicians, all the people in the room at the same time, no click track, no like fence around it, and just plugging in and going. That mood, that spirit, that's what was moving people to do the crazy stuff, because it's the collective part. It's like when you go into a giant stadium, all of those energies combine, and if the band is hitting it right, it will drive you completely insane. And the musicianship has fallen. I mean, it's fallen in regards to what the scene and what the powers that be give to us. There are so many bands that just are not famous that are as amazing as the old bands. But they might make it on Instagram by covering a song, and people are like, oh my God, four part harmonies, this is amazing. But they are not being thrust to the top.
Well, yes. And one of the hallmarks of rock and roll music, various iterations and offshoots, up to and including heavy metal, was it was music very much for alpha males. I mean, you may not have regarded yourself as an alpha male, but clearly when you hear these thrashing guitars, even bands that with hindsight, maybe even during that time period, some would have regarded as chick bands, which to me was just a way of saying a lot of chicks show up to the shows, which at the time was fine with me, right? But even the chick bands, you had some badass shredders, like in the Jonathan Cain years of Journey, still had Neil Schon on guitar, REO Speedwagon, Gary Rickrath. Okay,
Oh God, yeah.
those guys could jam. They were guitar gods, right? So it was very much alpha male music. And it seems to me, Ben, that over time, that was de-emphasized because if you look at the lack of support, and I would say really this kicked into high gear. The record labels have always screwed over artists, ripping them off left, right, and center. So many bands have these horror stories. Kansas, Queen, all of them ripped off, right? All of them ripped off. But then you look to the late 80s and early 90s, you began to have a de-emphasis of supporting the musical artist. There was no more effort at getting the best out of them. And then even before that, Steve Miller complained about, before he put out the Joker album, which got him, made him world famous, he said, I go to these cities to play, and there's not one of my records in any of the record stores, right? And he was really taking his label to task for that. You guys better do a better job, right? So I was watching these interviews. You remember one of the great rock and roll bands from the Bay Area back in the day, Y&T, good hard rock band. Dave Menichetti was giving an interview, and he said, there came a point in time when the record label just didn't care about us. They didn't want to help us. They didn't want to do anything for us. And then you look at another great Bay Area band at that time, Night Ranger. It was a similar dynamic. They came out with a ballad, Sister Christian, and then thereafter, the record label said, no, you can't do hard rock songs. You can only do ballads. That's where the money is, right? So they were in a rock and a hard place. And eventually the support from the record label, just caved in. And eventually they broke up. But the point being is there used to be a point in time when in order just to make money, these record labels would really push support and help these bands, bring in the best engineers, bring in the best producers, the best songwriters. That all went out the window. And then something like right out of left field, it seemed to me, and I don't know how you feel about this, But I was never a grunge fan because when that hit the scene, it's like it was so totally different from what I'd grown up to, these complex melodies, all that. And then it turned into like a two, three chord kind of thing. I didn't understand it, to be honest with you. So your thoughts on that or anything else?
Well, yeah. In keeping with what I said earlier, I was working at a guitar center in Minneapolis. The very first time I heard that Pearl Jam song, "I'm Still Alive." Oh, I'm still alive. And I remember hearing that chorus and going, "Your words don't match the mood of the music. The mood of that chorus sounds like giving the hell up." The opposite of the alpha, like positivity, like think of all of the 70s choruses of how they just punch you. Even if it's a dumb song, now you're messing with a, it still does the thing. And there was so much hopelessness in grunge music. In fact, I used AI to make a fake, someday I'm going to do something with this comedy stuff because with AI, I mean, you might as well have fun with the end of life as we knew it, but I made a fake grunge song with the worst lyrics because that's kind of where it would go, like all these really emasculated themes. So the song I made was called "This Roommate Thing Is Not a Good Fit," and he's like, "This roommate thing is not a good fit. You didn't pitch in on groceries," because that's like how dumb and like addled these songs were. So I thought that Nirvana had catchy tunes, but
Yes.
I didn't like the mood of
Yes.
and the context, the subject matter felt like a mood that I have to want to feel the mood that the song is delivering to me. And
Yes.
whatever mood, that despondency mood, I was not okay with.
Well, yes, that was the problem that I had with grunge, was that it went from rock and roll rebellion, muscle cars, girls, parties, but also, serious stuff. You look at the great songwriters of the past, Pete Townsend, what have you. I mean, they wrote really thoughtful songs, right? Kansas is another example. But Ronnie Van Zant was an underrated, great songwriter, right? But then you start to drift into the grunge aspect. Now, Billy Corgan, he mentioned something that he appreciated the insouciant style of writing, basically the indifferent style of writing of Kurt Cobain, and I can see where he's coming from, right? But for me, who grew up on songs that, ran the spectrum, that make you feel like, charged up, fired up, songs that made you feel melancholy, songs that brought you joy, songs that brought you sadness, it all points the entire gamut. Real music elicits those feelings, and they hit you at different times in your life, right? Whereas the indifference, the vapidness, the apathy of grunge, and also the droning atonal, I don't know if they downtuned the guitars or what, but yeah, but the kind of it worked, downtuning worked for Hendrix, didn't work for grunge, as far as I was concerned, because when you hear that and it's just like two or three chords, right? It just didn't do it for me, Ben. There
So
was.
the other thing about it is the tones of the guitars suck.
Yes.
There's so much distortion that it loses all impact. So
Yes.
contrast the guitar sound in like a Stone Temple Pilots song compared to AC/DC.
Yes.
AC/DC had Marshall stacks that were cranked up all the way to the point where they were on the verge of breakup, but they
Yes.
were punchy.
Yes.
Like everything is super punchy.
Yes.
When you have too much distortion on your guitar, it gets really indistinct and marshmallowy.
Yeah, there's almost a dirge-like effect to it, right?
It just doesn't have any impact. And also the production in so many of the in the 80s and into the 90s, everything lacked impact. And then you go back and read What, how did they record this Motown song that has so much punch?
Yes.
Oh, they put the guy, they put one drum, they put one microphone in front of the kit, and they put one behind his head, and then they all stood around and made sure the mics were exactly, and they all played in the room together.
Yes.
And then you isolate the bass, and you can't believe how much that bass is impacting this entire song. Bass playing in general has fallen to new lows.
Yes.
Bass is the most important thing. I
Yes, it
realized that
is.
as a guitar player who played his own bass over the years and realized, oh my God, I'm doing it. I'm doing it.
Yes.
But I'm not really moving. The bass is subliminally moving your gut.
Yes.
It's moving you all over the place. And people like Carole K, who was in on all those Motown sessions, and who's the main dude? James Jamerson, who would show up drunk, and they're like, the dude can't talk. There's no way he's playing today. And they'd say, roll the tape, and he was flawless.
That
I
was
don't know these.
the era of the great session players, from Jimmy Page on, well, John Paul Jones. That's how they got to know each other. You go
Yeah.
down the line. You had Steve Lukather. You had these
Oh, God.
phenomenal, Skunk Baxter. You had these guys that were like special operations session players. They can go to any genre of music and kick ass, right?
Yeah.
Dwayne
And
Allman.
this is
Dwayne Allman,
before
well,
this is,
also, right?
these guys were so disciplined and practiced so hard. And this is the age, and we forget so easily that you didn't have YouTube to
No.
watch. Hey, what is Edward Van Halen doing right here?
Yes, that's
Oh, I'll
right.
slow it down to 30%.
Yes.
Kids now are getting really good at instruments quickly
Yes.
because of the ability to watch. Whether or not that turns into them forming a meaningful band is another matter, because
Yes.
music is getting taken over now. You know, the training wheels for AI, honestly, was autotune. It was the first truly dehumanizing thing.
Yes.
Going from analog to digital was a problem because the magnetic tape actually records the ghosts, and all magnetism is such an important thing in the spiritual world.
Yes, it is.
Magnetic tape is pulling in those full linear performances. Digital is ones and zeros, and there's literal holes. You don't hear the holes, but you feel the holes. There's
Yes.
something missing. It doesn't work. Then when you lined up everything to a grid, suddenly the ebb and flow of the way life in nature works is lined up to this cage-like grid.
Yes.
And you could they came in with a drum doctor, which would oop, oh, look at your kick drum. It's a little forward here. Let's move it onto the grid. And suddenly all of what makes us human was taken out.
Yes.
So I realized I knew this was kind of the case, but I didn't feel it in an impactful way. Where it really hit me was just a few months ago when I was in Taiwan with my wife, and we were like listening to old music, and she wanted to listen to Whitney Houston because that was like one of her favorite singers because she's amazing. Well, we ended up, you know, it skips to The Greatest Love of All, right? Which has to be one of the biggest selling whatever. And I could not believe how flat Whitney Houston was in the most musical way. Flat the way that human beings can be a few cents or a few cents above or below, and it's gorgeous. But it was sticking out to me, and I realized, oh my God, all these years of hearing auto-tune stuff is making me feel like she's too flat. So now hearing humanness is off-putting to us,
Yes.
even musicians like me.
I think it's designed to do that. And for the benefit of our audience, please tell them what autotune is.
Auto-tune is came to prominence on Cher's hit. Do you feel what is it? Life after love after love. It's like this thing that will. It's a program that you put on vocals that will correct your vocals, and it can either be used clandestinely to make sure that you're always on the note, or it can be used as an effect like they use in rap where the voice is going like snapping into place.
Yeah.
used as an effect, I get it as a gag. But when you auto-tune everything, suddenly the people think there's 12 notes. Yeah, but there's micro tonalities in between the note. I can go, imagine if there was no bending in music and someone just went, play the pentatonic scale like. All of the micro tonality. All those in between notes, that's what your voice should be doing when you sing. You should be lifting up to the note. You should be overshooting that note and gently
Yes.
coming down. And so when you look at it on a grid, it looks like water.
Yes.
But auto-tune does not look like water. It looks like bump, 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 bump. It looks digital and
Yes.
artificial.
Yes. And I can't remember who said it, but and this applies not only to the guitar, but to the harmonica and other instruments that the best solos you can sing to. And to this
Yes.
day, in my head, I can do note for note in my head every great guitar solo I've ever heard. And Huey Lewis had something similar on harmonica. He was a superb harmonica player. And I've seen Paul Butterfield, but Huey Lewis is a great harmonica player. He said, I can make my, in so many words, I can make my harmonica playing more complex, but I want people to be able to sing to it, right? So,
Yes. Well, and I had a similar way of explaining how when I really love the guitar solo, and my thing was like it makes me laugh.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes.
So there's a comedy to like if you take something like it's funny.
Yes, it
There's
is.
something cartoonish and comical about that. And
Yes, there's
Joe Walsh,
something.
I think, was the master at having very vocal sounding,
Yes.
almost Sesame Street type solos that like make you laugh.
Yes, and another guy that I thought was similar was Jeff Beck.
Oh, God.
I used to always tell people, Jeff Beck, when he plays, it sounds like he's laughing at you, because
Yes.
it's especially the spacing between the notes. That today you have the Instagram shredders that just nothing but the technical lightning kind of riffing. But with Beck, it was like how he could bend the notes. Like, think of 'Cause We Ended as Lovers, a Stevie Wonder song that he did a musical cover over, instrumental. It's like the way he can just play, have the spacing, it just touched you at a soul level. But when he wanted to get comical, he made sounds that would just make me laugh.
Oh,
It's like he's laughing at us with his guitar, you know?
agreed. And that's, I'm glad that you brought up the spaces because the spaces are half of the music. There's too much, there isn't enough pause.
Yes.
So when we're hearing something, we can integrate things. You need a few milliseconds at the very least, or a second or two to integrate what just happened. And you know, the sort of call and answer to people who do have patience who play an instrument really
Well,
impacts the listener.
it goes back to what you said about holding the bottom with an effective bass player and a drummer. When they're in sync, and think of all the great rhythm sections in rock and roll, John Paul Jones, Bonzo, Keith Moon, John Entwistle, Roger Glover, Ian Paice. I mean, they just held the bottom and that allowed Blackmore, whoever, to do whatever they wanted to do on top. But it was like, it was, and when you're at a concert and the volume is cranked, you feel the bass in your chest, man. It's like boom, boom, boom. It's like, and
And then
now.
I was like years and years ago, I couldn't quite because I didn't figure it out yet, but I was like, how is AC/DC punching me in the face at every
Yes.
turn?
Yes.
And it's Phil Rudd.
Yes. One of the greats. Yes.
Phil Rudd was so in that pocket and playing
Yes.
with Malcolm and Angus, and
Yes.
he played virtually no fills. He
Yes.
didn't need fills.
Yes.
It's just like It's just like,
That's right. Now, what's interesting too is like these drummers who never escape the gravitational pull of the garage, let's say, right? When they talk about their favorite drummers, Phil Rudd is seldom mentioned. But when you talk to the actual players who played in arenas and stadiums, legends, they always talk about Phil Rudd. They always talk about Ringo Starr, one of my favorites.
Oh,
One of the
absolutely.
best, one of the best in the groove shuffle guys you'll ever find to this day was Ringo Starr.
Ringo does a thing that I tried telling drummers, and I can sit on the drums and I could jump in with the band. I just have my body knows what to do. I'm technically probably not that great, but I'm musical. And I had my first few drummers. I was like, dude, no. Because it would come time for to do like a little fill for them, and they'd be like, do 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 do. I'm like, no, make it sound like falling downstairs. Because Ringo would he would swing his fills every time.
Yes, the swing was
It was
awesome.
even if the beat was really straight, he would enter his fill a little earlier than you would think, not on the measure, not on the one. He would start it early and he'd swing that fill. And it provided this liquid quality to, he was an enormous reason why the Beatles were successful.
Absolutely. They wouldn't have been the same without him.
No, and every great drummer says that.
Yes.
And there's so many fun videos on YouTube of people like, no, let me show you why Ringo's amazing and why it's actually kind of hard to do what he does.
Yes, absolutely. And
Like,
getting
think of
back.
that tomorrow, you know, that Tomorrow Never Knows song?
Yeah.
That boo, tap. That is doing something even before the music starts. That is
Even.
like putting something, it's like shamanistic, and it's like
It is.
very tribal.
There's almost a tribal shamanistic aspect and percussions, like for example, like Run Like Hell with Pink Floyd. When you start hearing the percussion kick in, that's like you get in your mind, and based on the movie, of course, The Wall, you can see
Yeah.
people running through the streets and just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And also like Whole Lot of Love when Bonzo starts doing the percussions in the background,
Oh.
right? It just, you cannot. Instead, what it's been replaced with, Ben, is this, I don't even call it overlapping. There doesn't seem to be separation between, you know, the bottom and you know, the top. It's all just endlessly overdubbed. It's like overdub after overdub in the same key. Whereas if you listen with headphones,
Oh.
like the solo in Ramble On,
Yeah.
there's two different
Yeah.
keys that are going simultaneously with the same
Yeah.
licks. You know what I mean? So there's no
See what?
separation of the in the headphones anymore.
No. Somebody decided that hard panning, we're not going to do that anymore, which is so dumb. Because if you're on the wrong side or the right side of the room and Van Halen 1 is on,
Yes.
like, what happened to the guitar solo?
That's
Well,
right.
because it was coming out of one side,
That's right.
right? So, and the Beatles did this constantly. When I mix, I constantly do that. And I'll have other and like younger engineers listen and be like, do you really want to put that all the way over there? And I'm like, yeah, because it's weird and it spreads your ears out.
It does. It expands your consciousness when you listen to this
Right.
stuff, right? And so
Well, it's
we,
like a Hemi sync thing without people knowing that they're
it
doing
is.
that.
It
If
is.
you double your solo, your guitar solo, to give it some thickness, and then pan one right and pan one left, they're going to be slightly out of phase with each other, and you're doing a Hemi sync.
Yes. Yeah. And so all these tricks, and keeping in mind some of the great tracks laid down in the 60s, they had a four track recording system back then. Nothing like today. Like for example, when I was watching that movie, Some Kind of Monster, that Metallica documentary, right, a biopic, whatever it was. And then what they did was, which it never occurred to me, I didn't know if they were cheating or what. And, you know, as much as like Kurt Hammett, right? So it's like they use something similar to Audacity, where they essentially spliced. In the old days, they actually cut the tape and they spliced it. I understand that. But what they were able to do with the computers and the software was just really all these complex guitar runs, just all splice them together. And they would choose, well, this one, this one, this one, this one, which one do you want to put in here? I go, geez, that's what it's like nowadays. You know, it's like for Stairway to Heaven, Page did like four solos. He goes, I'll go with this one, right? The one we're all familiar with. But it makes it depersonalize. It takes out
No, you.
the human element of it, right?
Yes, you have to. If you start singing your song line by line, and then you've got like five takes, and you do that for each of the lines, and you go through, and you're like, okay, and they call it a malt. Okay, we'll make a malt of that performance. All of the continuity and the character is removed. It's like skipping around in a book or something like that.
Yes,
Like,
yes.
that's not what you want. That's not what you want to do. And although the listener will never consciously say, like, oh, I can totally tell that this person did that, they will feel a little more disconnected than they would have if you went from beginning. Because we already, okay, the lack of tape is already removing that magnetic linear
Yes.
experience. And now you're chopping up your performance and lining it up.
Yes.
Now it's all the way dehumanized. And what is this doing to us on a soul level,
Yes.
whether purposely or accidentally, always being subjected to this robotic music? It cannot be helping our
No,
soul.
it can't. And then you look at what the radio stations did. Excuse me. Well, back in the day, one of them was Clearwater Communications. They just owned so many radio stations in America. There was another one that owned, most of the rest. And it got to a state. And I remember this clearly. We went from album-oriented rock. It wasn't just side one, track one. When a new album came out, they'd play the whole bloody side, and then side two, right? And with the Hey Dave, the double albums, they'd play the whole bloody thing in the old days. But then it started gradually going side one, track one. We didn't get to hear the deep cuts in the albums. You had to buy the album, and then it goes from there to, like, well, the point I was going to make about this was we get these radio stations owned by these two major conglomerates, and no matter what genre of music, country, top 40, whatever the case may be, it was always the same seven or eight songs played on a loop continuously every single day. And I remember, okay, I remember I was working at a medical records department in Arizona, and I dreaded walking through the main office. Because they had a rule in the office that all the stations had to be tuned to the same station. But because they were going through that loop thing where they played the same seven or eight songs, you're like, oh God, it's a Sheryl Crow song. And then for the rest of the day, it's like, all I want to do, I just want to jump off a bridge,
No, that's
because
psychological
that's
torture.
psychological torture. And when you're having the same seven or eight songs, that feeds into these OCD loops in your head,
Oh no,
right?
that's no good.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, right? It's like
Oh,
the way they
absolutely.
want to push. Look, I'm gonna probably rub some feathers, hurt people's feelings out there. Forgive me, okay? But like, I never saw the fascination with U2. Never. I just didn't. Okay. Now, when I went to school in London in '87, it's all the kids were talking about Bono, Bono. I had no idea what they were talking about because I'm a cold, old stick in the mud kind of guy, old classic rock and roll. But you could he. The reason I bring up U2 is that was clearly a band to me that was pushed to the front when there's so many other bands far more talented musically, far have a lot more to say, didn't turn into sellouts, right? It's like they don't get emphasized. It's the bands that are kind of that nowadays could be used for social engineering purposes and entire genres of music that are pushed to the fore. And
Well,
the
look at how probably not a coincidence it is that Bono ended up being this guy who pushes the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and does all this like globalist
Yes.
stuff. I thought U2 had a cool little thrust there right in the beginning. They had a weird sound kind of, but there was a lot of other bands that could have. It's odd that they got pushed as hard as they did.
Yes. When you start seeing them on the cover of Time magazine and all these other major publications in America, and they were always in the talk show circuit. That tells me that they were being pushed. Whereas so many other bands that had a lot more to say, they got left by the wayside. And then let's take the phenomenon of MTV while we still have time in this first segment. That started from Les Garland. Les Garland was the program manager at KFRC AM, a top 40 station in San Francisco, the Bay Area where I grew up, right? And then he went out and he formed MTV. And if you remember that first, there was only so many videos. They played them on a loop, basically. But as time went on, more and more bands came out with the video content. And then what happened? And Billy Corgan once again talked about this. He saw the de-emphasis of rock and roll music, pop, pop music, what have you. And then it became, it all shifted all of a sudden to rap and to hip hop. And
100%.
this was in sync with the time period that Dave Menichetti talked about, when the record labels just stopped caring about basically that genre of music, got no help from them whatsoever. It shifted emphasis to hip hop and rap at the same time that the streets of LA and other inner cities were being flooded by
Crack cocaine.
cheap CIA crack cocaine, right? So all the things that were taboo when mostly white artists were putting videos up, well, you can't have, violence, you can't show guns. All of that went out the window with rap. And I remember what Wynton Marsalis, the great, jazz musician, said. He said, "The problem with rap music and hip hop is it locks you in a frequency. It's a repetitive rhythm." And then if you just throw in the lyrics on top of that, usually they have to do with, they're never uplifting like types of things. Like, again, we said earlier how it ran the gamut, all the different emotions of the spectrum. It could be on one side of one album in the old days, but now it's all just one thing, fueling all this angst and all this rage. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, we know that some of the more wholesome rap people were told, "Nah, we don't want that shit." And we know that the gangster rap was being pushed, and we know it was timed with the import of crack cocaine. And we also know that a lot of these the same people who profited off the music also were invested heavily in the prison industrial complex.
That's right.
So they were selling Thugville to influence the masses to keep the jails full. And what they came up with a version of cocaine that you could get addicted to maybe after doing it once or two times.
Yes, the crack, right? Where even a low budget drug addict with 5 or 10 bucks would be able to buy a rock or two, and that begat, oh,
And I
please.
can tell you, so I was at this bar in the early or late 80s or early 90s in Minneapolis. And I walked outside to see if I could bum a smoke from someone. And I saw some guys smoking. I'm like, "You got one to spare?" And the guy gave me a cigarette and I lit it, took a drag, and I was high as hell. And they all started laughing at me. And he put crack in the thing. So I know what it feels like to smoke crack. And then he was like, "I got more of that. I got more of that." And they're all like clapping and laughing. And I was like, "You guys suck, you know?" And I was so freaked out. I took off. And maybe 4 minutes later, the worst, like withdrawal of all time for a 3 minute high. Like, was I high? 100%. But I was angry too, because I knew it. I bet this worked though on some people. Like they'd be
Yes.
like, all of a sudden they're high and they're like, "Yeah, I'll take some more." And then they just give away. And then now they have it. And they're like, "Oh," and then it wears off. And they're like, "Well, I'll just have this today." You're done.
You're done. And the idea, whatever CIA lab tech or whoever came up with the idea of crack, right, to make it affordable to the masses, where literally in every street corner you could have a crack dealer, and this begat a lot of the drug wars between the Crips and the Bloods, which spread out all across America. So you talk about radical social engineering. And then I was watching this video. It was on this Christian channel, a lot of people that were born again and they're telling their testimony. And this one guy was saying, well, there's two stories that stick that come to mind. One guy was saying he was a white artist, right? and a hip hopster, and he was talking about how these lyrics would just flow into his brain, into his consciousness. It wasn't even like a muse, right? It was like these whole complex thought forms having to do with degeneracy, crime, violence. They would all come in rhymes, and he just write. It was almost like automatic writing, Ben, and he'd write them all down, and then that became his music. And then you wonder just how many other, not just the artists themselves that were writing these things, but the record labels. But they have their own stable of writers, probably in some cases entity infested. And then another guy I was watching, this black guy who, had a come to Jesus moment. He was a DJ in the hip hop music scene, and he just, was moving away from that whole scene, was becoming more Christian and all that. And I'm not trying to get religious. I'm just telling the guy's story to everybody. So he says he heard a voice in his head, go stand in the back of the dance club, right? So he did, and he went to the back of the dance club, and he looked at the stage. He looked at the hip hop artists on the stage, and then what he saw spiritually were all these demons coming out of the mouth of the singer, going into the audience, and they're just sucking it up. And I know that thing happens because I'm telling you, folks, I've seen similar things. The Black Sabbath Mob Rules tour. As much as I love Sabbath. It's just like their music can conjure up shit, man. I'm telling you, because I'm sitting there, right? Ronnie James Dio prancing around on the stage like a little elf. I'm just watching him is scary. And then he belt out that powerful voice that came out of nowhere. Geezer Butler was on my side, on the right side of the stage, and then Tony Iommi was on the left, and then Vinnie Appice and the big crosses, behind him. And what happened was, I noticed the movement above the stage. So I look up above and behind the stage, and I swear there were two demons cavorting around in midair, right? And I can, for some reason, I could zoom in on them, and I could see they had like little like purple hair, and they had cloven hooves, and they were like dancing and cavorting around above the stage, and occasionally they were sending zaps of energy down onto the swirling mass of people on the crowd, right? And I'm looking down, and it's like the people, compressed in front of the stage, swirling around the waves. I'm thinking, God, that looks hellish. And then I look up, there's demons down there shooting down at the crowd. And then honestly, I could only take so much. So I had to relieve myself. I had to go out into the corridors to just, kind of ground myself. And the corridors at the Cow Palace were just filled with people. I just couldn't take it either, So the point I'm making is, yeah, the point I'm making is this is not something that's exclusive to rap, because the way Iommi played, I think he down-tuned his guitar also, right, at times. So there would be like a dirge-like effect to some of their music, and it literally plugged into a frequency that was able to conjure these things up. You know what I mean? So point of relevance is music can influence us in a lot of ways, positively or malignly. And so clearly the record label, at the behest of the CIA and the social engineers, they said, okay, we're going to shift the rap, hip hop. We're going to turn the inner cities into war zones. And this is what we're going to emphasize. And a lot of people forget the earliest well-known rappers were against all forms of oppression. That's what he became a TV actor later on.
Ice tea or ice cube?
Ice T, yes. If you listen to a lot of lyrics, he was talking about, police oppression and the inner city, and why people shouldn't live like that, right? And from the standpoint of a former dealer himself, it's like he was giving lived experience, but what they did was they took that and then they gangsterized it, glorified it, right? So yeah. And then it got to the point where you couldn't even turn on MTV and see any white artist anymore. And it all completely changed.
Well, and when you think of while they were doling out that crack cocaine and had that really just really violent gangster rap that they were pushing, white music, which they were creating a big divide, was very rated G with the exception of grunge, which was like a hopelessness rock. There was a lot of solo female singer songwriters. There weren't any male singer-songwriters. There was no masculine counterpoint to the gang thug life. It was Jewel. It was Sheryl Crow. It was Sean Colvin. It was, I mean, there were 20 top 10-ish female singer-songwriters and no males at that time. It was like the gangster rap and then really kind of whimsical, nice. But there was nothing for the males besides the hopelessness of rap. And it wasn't, you know, everybody decided that at that point that anything that was celebratory in nature was like shallow. And I get it, but there's a place for shallow,
Yes.
normal celebration, right?
Yes.
Or just something that feels good. I mean, that we always had that in it manifested differently in every decade for sure. Like in the 50s, you didn't even have to have lyrics. You could just be shagalaga bing ba bong ba dang
That's
dong
right.
dong.
That's right.
So whatever. And then 60s had the beach and surf, and the 70s
Yes.
had the celebratory party
Yes.
stuff.
Yes.
There was no such celebration in the 90s. It was all like
No.
super heavy, dark introspection and
Yes.
gangster.
Yes. And then you fast forward to today. What does Taylor Swift talk about? Failed relationships. It's like whoever wrote her lyrics for her. The target audience was liberal feminists on one or more psychiatric drugs, right? Just the
Right.
hopelessness, the breakups, the unfaithful partners. It's just what it's done, it's doing is reinforcing in that. To those particular fans that listen to that, oh, so like Taylor Swift talks, all she talks about is sheer misery. So I'm just going to wallow in sheer
I'm
misery too.
normal.
And yeah.
Yeah, none of the song, it's all about I'm lost without you. I can't go on without you. I got screwed over. Nothing about personal empowerment.
Yeah, nothing
Think
about
of
it.
even like obviously Ozzy didn't write like his solo stuff. He had a cadre of some of the most amazing people ever, but
That he all fired after a while. Yeah, you're right.
the first two Ozzy records are still some of my favorite. But
Yes.
think of how empowering the lyrics are on those.
Yes.
Like Over the Mountain is all
Yes.
about having your own like breakthrough experience.
Yes.
It's about love. It's they're anti-war, completely positive.
Yes. Even Suicide Solution, which the Christian
Right.
fundamentalists had twisted all around as a pro-suicide song, no. It's like when Daisley and Lee Kerslake, I can't remember which one of them wrote the song, but I think it was Lee Kerslake, but he wrote it because clearly Ozzy was on a downward slope. He was going to drink himself to death, right?
Right.
So that's why he wrote the song Suicide Solution. It was a biography about Ozzy, telling him to
Yeah.
shape up, basically, right? It had nothing to do with
Yeah.
encouraging people to commit suicide, right?
No.
And so you have, and even within the musical genres, you had the so-called like California music scene, like Linda Ronstadt, and then breaking off from the Eagles, and you had the great Ricky Nelson and the Stone Canyon Band. And you had certain genres within the larger pop rock music scene, right? And of course, I liked all genres. I didn't limit myself to
Yeah.
like any one, you know? So you had variety, but what's happened over time, to your point, is our options have narrowed, right? There's only so many genres that are pushed, and everything is digitalized.
Yeah.
Rick Beato talks about,
Well, they don't have, yeah, he talks about how they took away all the program directors
Yes.
and their autonomy. They used to be able to pick stuff.
Yeah.
That's why you would hear, hey, what was your big hit? They'll be like, oh, you know, this one radio station in Cincinnati started playing our song, and then it caught on.
Yes.
That never happens
No,
anymore.
it doesn't. That's how that classic song "Blackwater" by Doobie Brothers became number
Yeah.
one. It was side B of a 45 that the DJ played by accident, and then all these people were calling in. Hey, what's that song? Can you play it again? And then it became number
Yeah, the
one,
good old
right?
days when B-sides continually, and that's proof that people, if you let people decide,
Yes.
they'll find good stuff, even if it was a mistake. They'll be
Yeah,
like,
that.
there's so many B-sides were hits back then.
Yes, there were, and also the artists themselves had so much musical control. Like think about Jimmy Page as the producer. of his Zeppelin records. Huey Lewis in her news, they insisted that no, we're going to produce this, no one else, right? And then that produced a sports album and what have you. So when they're left to their own devices, these musicians can really come out with some great music. And you talked about the doo-wop scene earlier, and the the 50s music, then going into the Ventures and then the beach music. What I've noticed also, and probably not anymore, but certainly in the 80s and the 90s, a lot of people really appreciated these throwbacks that harkened back to the old music. Think of the Stray Cats, right? Think of Huey Lewis and all the a cappella that they did, right?
I mean, they were a 50s band.
They're a
The Huey
50s
Lewis
band.
was like they had the discipline of the Beach Boys, basically.
That's right. And so what happens is when people hear that stuff, it takes them back to a different time, right? And yes. And of course, Brian Setzer, the Brian Setzer Orchestra, right? So it's interesting that, oh, like when Gary Moore said, oh, you know what? I really love the blues. I'm just going to be a blues player. No. You're going to lose all your fans. No, his popularity went through the roof, because at a soul level, Ben, that's what we want. That's what we crave, is that
Yeah,
music
that's
that
why
makes us
that you
think and
were able to
feel.
have almost an entire decade, the 90s, of revivalist swing music.
Yes.
Because it wasn't just, it was also Cherry Poppin' Daddies, and it was that whole, and even though there was a shtick to that, they were well-written songs,
Yes.
and the players could play.
Yes.
They could play very, very well. And that revivalist thing continues in these pockets. There's a band, I don't know if you're aware of them. It's two brothers called the Lemon Twigs. And they came out of Long Island about 14 years ago, and one was 17 and one was 18. And they were the Beatles, the Who, and the Stones rolled into one, convincing. And they're still going, and they keep hitting it out of the park. And I luckily, when I flew back from Taiwan this last time and was cat sitting for my sister in Chicago, I was like, I wonder if the Lemon Twigs are playing while I'm here for 4 days, because I've missed them throughout the years. And sure enough, they were. And there were, I don't know, maybe 1,000 people. They don't draw, they get 1,000 people in every city, which is good. But they were flawless and perfect three-part harmonies, every player amazing. So these bands do exist in these pockets, but they never, and they might get on Kimmel. They might, they'll be on, they'll get invited, but they'll never be household names.
No.
But they would be if somebody put their song front and center in a major Hollywood movie, if they brought them up, because people do want that. But unfortunately, we get what we get.
That's right.
And you've seen how Rick Beato does that top 15 on Spotify all the time. And he's very nice about it. Some of this stuff is well written. They've got 50 writers per artist, right? That are like cutting and pasting from the best ideas. And there are some catchy tunes out there, but they're very formulaic. And they
Yes.
never wander. I can't stand those chord progressions that I've been hearing for like 40 years, over and over. I'm like, no, don't do it again. It is torture. It's like, why did they play Umbop from Hanson outside of Waco to drive those people nuts? And then they do it to us, but we get
Yes.
seven songs to get tortured with. You know what I mean?
Well, that's right. And I talked about that, the OCD thought loops, where we have this rule in the office. There was like a records room where all the records, hard copy records, it wasn't digitized back then. So you had like the records room where I spent a lot of time, the main office room, and then the boss's room, right? And there was two radios, and they both had to be on the same radio station. So it's like I if I had earplugs, or I should have just stuck my fingers in my ears. But when I would walk through the space and catch one of those seven or eight songs, it would just be stuck in my head. I'd have to be sitting in the records room going la 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 la, trying, thinking of an old Kink song or something. You know what I mean?
Yes, it's really bad. And Nathan's talked about this, about how they can loop. He said this to me on the phone one time, and I'm like, you're the only person that I have ever talked to that brought this up. I didn't even think of bringing it up, but I had a spell where I was kind of getting attacked a lot, and I would lay down to go to bed, and I'm telling you, there wasn't a song in my head. I can't get this song out of my head. It was playing on loop.
Yes.
And it was always a song I didn't like in the first place. I'm like, oh, and it was torturous. Like,
Yes. And I've got a story about that. Could you stick around for another half, another
yeah,
segment?
please.
Okay, because I've got a story about that. It relates directly to mind control, what I was subjected to. Oh, it was horrific. But it was about
Yeah, I
this
want to hear.
externally beamed in song into my head in the wake of a horrific mind control experience. But anyhow, we reached the end of
Yeah.
the first segment with the old friend Ben Gordon. Ben, if people want to get a hold of you, would you rather have them get hold of you through me, or would you like to give your email address or whatever?
Yeah, my email address is Benjamin Gord, GORD at gmail.com. You can also find my music at bengordonshow.bandcamp.com. I've got like 17 albums or something, 18 albums. If you like
Yeah.
old music, it sounds
Well,
like old, but yeah,
that's me.
that's how to
I'll
get
plug
me.
into that. And for our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, you believe in what we do, please go to thecosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member. We'll see you at the top of the next segment.